Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The United States is now going through the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. In response, the government has dedicated over $780 billion to an economic stimulus package and spent nearly as much to support the country's financial system. Here's the question that we want to try to take up this morning. Is this the right approach? Or, as some people would say, does this represent a dangerous expansion of government power? This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Sylvia Maxfield. She is a professor of management at the Simmons School of Management. That's in Boston. And she is joining us here this morning by telephone. We'll try to talk a little bit about the current economic crisis and to give people an opportunity to call in with their own questions and comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, calls are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief so that we can keep moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, participation by listeners is welcome. Our guest, Sylvia Maxfield, has worked both in the academic and business worlds before coming to Simmons College in Boston. She taught business and international economy and corporate government and business relations as professor at Harvard and Yale. She also served as the academic director of Yale's MA program in international affairs. She also worked as the senior sovereign analyst for Latin America at Lehman Brothers and has consulted widely with many organizations, including World Bank and Mitsubishi International. And again, as I said, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Maxfield, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Terrific. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. One hardly knows where to start with all of this because it's a complicated story. Maybe I'll just start because I'm interested in what you think about the item that's one of the items that's leading the news today, and that is the head of General Motors was asked apparently to quit by the Obama administration as a condition of the government's help to the company. And I suppose this will yet be another thing that people will point to and say that this is an overextension of government power and that the United States government shouldn't be going around telling companies who their CEOs should be. And I guess I'm just interested in whatever reaction you have to this story.
Well, the markets also seem to be trading off, apparently, on this news. It's a little bit difficult to figure out what makes the markets trade up and down these days. But, you know, GM's management, it has not been particularly good for a long period of time. I'd be hard-pressed to find anyone out there who could say, oh, GM's been incredibly well managed, the board's been on top of things, the management team has been terrific. So, you know, this seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and I think that there are lots of business people who've been saying for a long time that there needed to be a management shakeup.
I suppose, though, at the same time, there would be some people who would say, well, maybe that should be up to the board and perhaps to the stockholders of GM, and that for the government, essentially, to come along and give the guy a shove. Is that really the right thing for government to be doing?
Well, I think that we're in a mode of public discourse right now where almost anything is getting thrown into the category of too much government intervention. And, you know, we have a financial crisis and an economic situation. I'm not sure I'd call it a crisis, but we have a severe recession. We have a financial crisis. And it's covering up a debate that was very clear in this last presidential campaign about economic policy. And, you know, you had the Republicans continuing with a small government stance, and you had the Democrats clearly calling for something else. And so I think that what's so difficult about the press coverage of the current situation is it's sensationalized, and we're looking at a budget and we're looking at a series of crisis management moves And we don't understand how much of that is about changing the course of this country and how much of that is about crisis management. Mm-hmm. I think in the GM case, it's about crisis management, possibly tinged by politics. I mean, you certainly can't throw lots more taxpayer money at private companies and as the Democratic Party and risk a popular backlash that, you know, that says, well, you know, the leaders of these companies are getting off scot-free while the rest of us are losing our jobs.
Yeah.
So I think the primary thing here is trying to do the right thing with taxpayer dollars, and the secondary issue is, you know, how it's being interpreted by the press.
Yeah.
in light of the AIG. You know, this is about AIG. This is about, you know, those folks taking out bonuses, and how can we put any more money into companies when that kind of thing is allowed to happen?
Well, that perhaps it takes me into a slightly different area, and that has to do with the way people feel, the popular mood, people's expectations, either their sense of optimism or lack of optimism, and what that means for the economy. Now, I think it was Phil Graham who got in a lot of trouble some time back by saying essentially, oh, this economic downturn business, it's all in people's heads. But I suppose that it does have, you know, what happens with the economy does have something to do with consumer confidence and whether people are spending their money, whether they're investing it, whether they're just parking it in a bank in the most secure place that they can because they're worried. And clearly the administration, in what it has done, has had this in mind. I'm sure that they want to project the image that they are, that they do have a plan, that they are doing something. And so when something like the AIG bonus story comes along, of course the president and the Congress have to be righteously infuriated. And in a case like this, perhaps it's appropriate that the government be seen to be leaning on somebody who was heading a corporation and, in the estimation of a lot of people, maybe even people within the corporation, maybe not doing such a great job. So I suppose that gets at this question. What exactly is the relationship between the psychology of the nation and how people feel and how the economy is doing, and whether, in fact, if people do start to feel more optimistic, that that's actually going to make a difference?
Well, there's a burgeoning field of economic psychology or the psychology of economics, however you want to put it, and it's a fascinating field, but I don't know that that's all that relevant at this point. The bottom line is that you can get an economy to grow in one of four ways. You can get people who live within the nation's borders to consume. You can get foreigners to consume things that you can produce. You can get the government to buy things, or you can get corporations themselves to expand employment and to buy things. And the U.S. relies for growth on consumption, or at least when the economy ground to a halt last fall, we were relying on consumption by people who live within our borders to a larger extent than we ever had before, and that percentage had been growing pretty rapidly. So Americans are not going to spend us out of this recession. We are in a period of recalibration where the engine is going to have to be American spending, the government spending, foreigner spending, and eventually businesses expanding again. But it's going to take some time for that to happen. So, you know, I would agree with those who are a little bit annoyed with Phil Graham, because I think that there are there's a structural readjustment in terms of what the engine of growth is, and I just don't see consumer confidence getting us out of this. Obviously, consumers have to become a little bit more confident, and they've got to be a part of it. But you know, I think part of this debate is that government's also got to be a part of it. We're all Keynesians now. And, you know, that's not something that we've been used to in the U.S. for a very, very long time. We've been used to growth driven by consumption and actually by American consumption. You know, we've obviously been net consumers for the rest of the world. American consumers have been not only driving U.S. growth, but they've been driving pretty much everyone else's growth as well. And it's going to take a while to figure out some new sources of growth, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Sylvia Maxfield. She is Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College. That's in Boston. And we're talking about the current response, the government response to the current economic situation. And also one of the things we definitely want to talk about is the argument that some people have made that this is big government run amok. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I suppose the debate about the place of government and how much the government should be involved in people's lives and how much it should be involved in the economy, that's the kind of thing that that's not new. But at the same time, I guess the current situation and the government response has added fuel to that fire, you know, has intensified that debate between people who think that essentially the government should just stand back and kind of let the market rip, and those people who say, no, it's really actually important for the government to be much more involved, and that if the government does get involved, then things will turn around sooner. I think that there are some people who, in fact, I think a lot of people seem to make this argument that things are going to turn around no matter what, but the question is, how long is that going to take, and will government involvement shorten that time period? Is that something that you can talk about? And do you think that, in fact, that there's anything new to this argument?
New to this argument being that the government is too involved?
Yes. Then? Or you know, maybe the argument is, well, how involved should the government be? And it's the argument between the people who really say hands off, and I suppose there's some question about how many people there are who truly say hands off, you know. So it's an argument, I guess, over just how much the government should be involved.
Right. Well, it goes back to what I said earlier, which is, you know, this debate confuses two things. One is how much should the government be involved in a time of crisis, and in the specific instance of a serious, serious financial crisis in one of the world's largest leading capital markets. That's one issue. How much should the government be involved in times of severe economic recession? You know, that's another set of arguments. And then there's a more partisan discussion about whether, as a model, government should be more involved in normal times in this country, right? And so there's three different arenas in which you have to consider that question. Government needs to be involved in financial crises. There was a fabulous study that was put out through the IMF last year, and they looked at dozens of financial crises over the past 30 or 40 years, and it was very clear that that swift and appropriate government intervention that in most cases amounted to expropriating the equity holders of the failed financial institutions meant that those financial crises ended most quickly and least expensively for taxpayers. So you need government intervention. I think that the government intervention that we saw last fall did not fit the model of quick, efficient, and effective intervention. But you absolutely have to have government intervention. Financial markets are full of imperfections. Capitalism in some ways you know, it relies on perfect markets, and financial markets are far, far from perfect. I think that, you know, the question of whether you need a lot of government intervention to turn around the economic recession hinges on how much is a lot. And again, you know, what kind of spending? And, you know, the debate is, you know, has this come quickly enough? And do we need it to be a coordinated global reflation that, you know, where the stimulus is not just in the U.S., but it's in China and it's in Japan and it's in Europe, which is dragging its feet. And, you know, so that's a little bit harder for me to, you know, it's a little harder for me to come out and say, well, you know, I'm clearly a Keynesian and we should be spending a lot. You've got to contextualize that. I think that this budget that we're looking at as taxpayers right now is a little disappointing. You know, Obama campaigned on a platform of, you know, trying to get over politics by earmarking, and this budget is full of earmarks. So, you know, we're up against some serious political constraints. Yeah. I'd spend money differently, you know, if I were king for a day, and Obama's not king for a day. He's got to deal with a complicated political system. socialism. I think what the right wing, when they charge socialism, what they're trying to say is you're using this crisis to hide the fact that you're fundamentally changing the way government should be involved in the economy in normal times. And I don't think that's what's happening. I don't think that the Obama administration is revolutionizing government involvement. Yes, there's more spending called for in education. The environmental policy is actually a very market-oriented environmental policy. Healthcare strikes me as not particularly socialist at all. It's not a single-payer system, and it's based on principles of efficiency and choice. On the last part of that question, I don't think what we're seeing is a shift towards either fascism, which is what some people are saying, or socialism.
Well, one further question, and we're getting some calls lined up. For those people who would say that the approach to stimulating the economy that the administration has taken, this, in a sense, direct injection of money into it, is substantially different than the government approach to stimulating the economy that we have been taking now, at least for the past I don't know how many years. Some people say, in fact, this is the most significant effort of its kind since the New Deal. Now, that's probably saying a lot and maybe saying too much. But does this represent some sort of really dramatic change, particularly to the subject of economic stimulus?
I'm an economist. I like to think about numbers. But what we've seen in the past 10 years is that government spending as a percentage of GDP in the U.S. has risen from 34% to 40%. And the Europeans are at 48%, right? So that number is take all of the absolute value of the budget, and then you put GDP on the bottom, in the denominator of the fraction, and what do you get? And so we used to be in the 30s, and we're hitting 40, and Europe is pushing 50%. So we're still way behind quote unquote socialist Europe, with big government. But we're running the printing presses in the United States right now to fund this. We're borrowing to some extent, but we're also just printing money, and that's something that we haven't done in this country for a very, very long time. We are spending way beyond our tax revenue, and I would argue way beyond our ability to borrow in the bond markets as well.
Mm. Well, and does that mean that sooner or later we're going to see some big wave of inflation hit us?
I think we will. Timothy Geithner got in a lot of trouble last week for suggesting that the U.S. dollar might not be the global reserve currency forever, and he had to eat those words. But he's a smart guy. He's not the only person thinking about what happens to the dollar's role in the global economy when we start having to deal with the amount of debt we're taking on and how we're financing it.
We are going to take some callers here. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Sylvia Maxfield. She is Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts. We're talking about the economy, the response to the current situation on the part of the government, and how people are talking about that, particularly this question of is that or is that not an overextension of government power. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our lines are full, so callers will help us if they can be brief. We'll start in Oakwood, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was reading today the Gazette, letters to the editor, and I think I heard something about this a while back with Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, and somebody else evidently saw it too, and they were talking about what to do with this.
I'm sorry, caller, you're breaking up to the point that we can't even understand your question.
Okay, is that any better?
That's a little better. Yeah, go ahead.
All righty. Well, The Daily Show had something about this the other day, and there's a letter to the editor in the Gazette this morning, mm-hmm, about what to do with this big $784 trillion surplus or whatever we're going to use, not surplus, but aid package or whatever you want to call it. And he had an interesting idea. Why not go ahead and dole it out to the people instead of the corporations? I think he said something, give everybody 50 or 100,000, let them pay off their debts. With, you know, with that understanding being stipulated, they had to use it to pay mortgages, debts, make major purchases, appliances, cars, whatever, and let the people have the money and put it back into the economy. And he was saying that would go ahead and fix things quick.
Huh.
And I was just curious what you thought.
Well, that's an interesting point. I guess it makes me think about the approach to the economy that the Bush administration took. And actually, they did that. They, in fact, they sent everybody a check. Now, it wasn't $50,000. It was a small amount of money. But I think the idea was they thought people would go out and spend the money. And in fact, what they did was they put it in the bank or they used it to retire debt. And it didn't have much of an effect. But if it was a bigger check, would that make more difference?
Well, I think that, David, you've hit on the initial answer, which is I think in the current environment, an awful lot of people would save that money. You know, paying off your debt amounts to saving money. So I think in an odd sort of a way, again, to come back to this, you know, government's role in the economy, the Obama administration, which is being accused by the Republicans of being socialist, is in fact being very capitalist, you know, and they're not satisfying anybody because on the left you've got people saying, well, they're giving all the money to the corporations, and on the right you're saying, you know, they're intervening in the economy too much. You know, so I think the caller's onto something, which is from a political perspective, you know, this almost looks like a no-win thing to be giving all this money to corporate America. I think that's why you saw a budget that, you know, was full of extra spending for education, you know, and looks to some people like, you know, like it's a tax and spend budget, because I think the Obama administration is trying to do everything. They're trying to support corporations so that they can be the motor of our capitalist economy, and also trying to prove that there is also something in their policies for the average person, even though they've chosen not to just take all this money and write, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 checks to every household. It's an interesting idea, and, you know, this debate came up when we were looking at the bailout back in September. You know, very, very smart economists differed heatedly over, you know, you're going to spend this money, you know, where are you going to inject it into the system? You know, why don't you just pay people's debts off, or why don't you just buy the debts, everyone's debts? So, you know, we're probably not going to solve that from an economic standpoint, but it's interesting to think about from a political standpoint.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank the caller for the comment. Let's go to Effingham next, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'm going to ask you a pertinent question. Do you understand dialectics?
I'm going to have to say no, so I'm not going to be able to comment on that.
Well, let me then inform you. Dialectics consist of three phases: thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And in my opinion, and hopefully someone will catch on to what I'm saying and understand that the failures of capitalism in the last 300 years of its 700-year history now, in my opinion, is in its synthesis and fading fast, because war solved the 30s depression. We have two wars now, and there is no effect other than that it is declining, and that that all the money has been spent on that sort of nonsense. But to reiterate what I said, when something is in this synthetic phase, it is imminent that change is on the way, or annihilation. And thank you, and I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, well...
Well, I'm hoping it's not annihilation, but I would certainly agree that that there's change in the air.
Well, although clearly the caller is referencing Karl Marx, And I suppose ever since Marx, people have been predicting the fall of capitalism, and it hasn't happened yet. When you say that there's change coming, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, we have been living an era of deregulation in the United States. And I just got done spending an awful lot of time looking very, very closely at our securities market regulation over the last 15 to 20 years. So, you know, I think and there are all kinds of news leads out even this morning about global regulators pondering how to regulate the financial system, the international financial system and national financial systems to fix the problems that got us here. And they, of course, that won't fix the problems that we're going to see in the future. But you know, that's like we're always fighting the last war. But we're gonna in the United States, we're gonna live an era of more government intervention in the life of the market through regulation. And I think it's going to be very clear in finance, and maybe it'll just be limited to finance. But we've been in an era of government rollback on the regulatory side.
So do you think that what has happened here, particularly the bubble in real estate and the financial chaos that resulted when it collapsed, is that in what part is that, can we attribute that to regulatory failure or to lack of regulation?
Well, you know, initially the meltdown was due to it came from two places and they were related. It came from subprime mortgage lending, and then it came from the securitization of all kinds of borrowing, right? So we've had a growing, quote-unquote, parallel or shadow financial system in this country for the last decade that was completely unregulated. Congress had given nobody in the government authority to regulate derivatives traded in over-the-counter markets. And so what you had is you went into an auto dealership, you wanted to buy a car, the salesman went and looked up your credit rating and said, here, I can make you a loan. And that didn't go through a deposit-taking commercial bank. That went right into the securities market, and that was not regulated. There was no authority to regulate derivatives, which Warren Buffett calls financial weapons of mass destruction. And the limited effort to regulate those was essentially called a voluntary supervised program of self-regulation overseen by the SEC, and that was put in place in 2004, and it was summarily dismantled in the fall of last year. And so that will all be regulated. That will all be regulated, and mortgage markets are fixing themselves. They were heavily regulated. So the problem doesn't really lie with the institution, with Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae. The regulatory problem doesn't lie there. The regulatory problem lies with the securities markets.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Sylvia Maxfield. She's associate professor of management at Simmons College. That's in Boston. And before coming to Simmons, she taught business and international economy and comparative government-business relations as professor at both Harvard and Yale. Also, she was the senior sovereign analyst for Latin America at Lehman Brothers and has done a lot of consulting with organizations including the World Bank and Mitsubishi International. We're talking about the economy, the government response to the current economic downturn, what people are saying about that. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Next is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Your guest started to touch on the duration of recession depressions, and I wish he'd pick that up again. I would point out that the depression of the 1930s actually began, well, in agriculture in the early 1920s. For the remainder of the population in the middle 20s, and did not improve until Roosevelt's spending in the early 30s, 33, 36, and that there was a relapse in 37 when he cut back on that spending, trying to balance the budget. I could go back to ancient times in the 1830s. 1837 crash persisted until the Civil War. And I would point out that it's not wars that bring countries out of recessions, it's the spending that accompanies the war. Would you comment on these theses?
It is, and I hope that there aren't any young people listening to this show, because I do sometimes worry about the anxiety that's created amongst our children when we say, you know, it took a war to get us out of the depression of the 1930s, and not just any war, right? We're fighting some wars now, but it took an extraordinarily expensive war. And I, you know, there are that can be proven in economic history, that running the printing presses to finance wars, you know, leads to a lot of economic dislocation, after which you eventually put the pieces back together and you see some growth. But I'm looking at a picture right now, which I wish I could show you, but we're limited to audio. I mapped the five periods of significant growth decline in the U.S. I did this way back last fall, and starting with the 1930s, and the caller is exactly right, but it's not just the 1930s. Every single one of those, in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 70s, and then in the 80s, are W's. So you have a big decline, then you've got some recovery, then you have another decline, sometimes as sharp as the first one, not always, and then you recover back into a period of you know, more or less stable growth until you hit the next one. So, you know, I suspect that this will be another W situation, where we're going to see a growth rebound, you know, probably, you know, in 2010, and then we're going to see another pullback, and then another rebound. So, you know, I think over the next 5 years, it's not going to be possible to imagine a nice steady return to, you know, even 2% growth. I don't think we're going to see that. I think we'll see some growth, and then I think we'll see some recession, and then I think we'll see some growth again. And over that time period, there'll be some pretty big dislocations, you know, in terms of which sectors of the U.S. economy and what are driving growth and what the sources of growth are.
All right, let's go to another caller. This will be Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi, I have one little detail that I wanted you to comment on, and then a couple of broader questions, if I could. But we've heard the truism that, and the host just repeated it, that the amount of money that was rebated, which was, you know, right before the election, basically was saved or and such. But it pretty much correlates with the spike in energy prices. And it seems to me that somebody could run the numbers and say that that amount of money probably was transferred to the oil companies through our hands. And it also doesn't seem like a very surprising legacy of the oligarchy that was in with Bush-Cheney. But there was a previous economist from Hudson Institute on this is a broader question, and I use the expression military Keynesianism, which has been referred to in the context of the large war. But, I mean, there's sort of this premise that the U.S. hasn't been intervening industrial policy, hasn't had a large, the government hasn't been. But defense spending has, I believe it's what pulled Reagan out of his recession that he sort of engineered and had the lowest popularity rating in 82 prior to Bush coming in and getting a lower rating. But so I just, you know, there's sort of an unspoken premise that the U.S. isn't into, you know, government spending as an industrial policy, as an economic policy, when it's pretty clear that the spending, you know, you can't justify it all by status of forces around the world, et cetera, et cetera. So it's clear, and then when you look at the transparent nature of how, you know, an airplane that costs $5 billion has parts made in almost every district in the country. So, I mean, it just seems like the hypocrisy of people suggesting that, you know, this is just ghastly that the government is, you know, intervening. Anyway, I've probably beaten that into the ground, so I'd like to hear you
Yeah, go ahead, Professor Maxwell.
I agree entirely. You know, we have since the 1950s in the U.S. Used government policy to subsidize the housing market, the agricultural sector, which you probably all know about out there in the Midwest, and the defense sector. So I would agree that there's been government support for particular sectors of the U.S. economy. I might add that Social Security, Medicare, even an income tax. Government has been involved in the U.S. economy in significant ways for a long time.
Maybe I'll give the opportunity for the caller to follow up. Did you want to?
Yeah, I did have another point, but you have a full bank, so I'll just ask you to comment on my first point, which is, did you ever run the numbers to see whether the subsidy or the rebate actually even paid for the increased energy cost, and that it clearly isn't something that paid off anybody's debt or enhanced spending, except that went directly into the oil companies?
I think if one ran those numbers, you'd find that the average household's increased spending with the oil price increase that occurred in the last, half of the second Bush administration is way, way, way higher than the value of those rebate checks. So I think, it probably wasn't, quote unquote, saved. It may have prevented households from going further into debt.
All right. Well,
it kept credit card balances from growing more than they might have otherwise.
Let's go to another caller here in Sycamore, line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning. Your comments earlier about inflation piqued my interest, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the timing of how long it will take from this cranking up of the printing presses of money until that will be reflected in presumably higher inflation rates and also presumably higher interest rates. Go ahead.
If I could call that timing, much as I love working in the field of education, I would probably be working in a different field. But we're already starting to see it now. There are inflation-linked bonds, and those were dirt cheap back in December, and you're seeing their prices go up. So, unfortunately, I think everybody in the world who spends time thinking about economics and finance believes, and this will to some extent make it a self-fulfilling prophecy, I'm afraid, that a significant recovery in the U.S. is going to be associated with inflation. I am not an expert in, how you conduct monetary policy in complicated markets, but I just don't see how the United States can possibly get out of the amount of debt that we're taking on without some inflation. And I also believe the commodity paradigm people who say, well, look at the growing size of the middle class around the world and look at the commodities, the supply of commodities. Don't you believe that there's going to be inflation also coming from commodity prices? So I believe both of those sources of inflation, are going to be operative in the world over the next couple of years. How high inflation gets in the U.S., I don't know. I don't think we're going to become a hyperinflation country. I do have faith in our central bankers, but I think I think we'll see inflation.
But that means then that we're going to have higher interest rates to go along with that, and that always means bad things for the economy, right?
Yes. We will see higher interest rates, and that may be part of the scenario that gets me to my W growth pattern that I talked about earlier. I think it's not a very simple scenario is growth picks up a bit, commodity driven price increases, the dollar falls, commodity prices go up, we start to see an uptick in inflation. The central bank is meant to, quote-unquote, lean against the wind, so they're supposed to see those things coming and compensate, and we would see a small uptick in interest rates, and that would then, you know, slow the economy back down again. That's probably the good scenario. The bad scenario is probably, you know, we don't see that kind of policy measure. We just continue to see an expansionary monetary policy. And, you know, that probably isn't a good thing because it suggests that we, you know, we're between a rock and a hard place and we can't raise interest rates. We've got to let inflation take hold in order to make sure that we've got growth coming back.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Sylvia Maxfield. She is Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College in Boston. We're talking about the economy, the response of the government to the current economic conditions. Maybe also we started talking out a little bit about the way people have been throwing around the term socialism these days to describe the action of the government. Questions welcome. We do have several, and probably if we take everybody, that's going to be what we'll do. But if other folks want to try and get in line, that's fine. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next over to the community of Belgium, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, all. I'd like to be as quick as I can. First off, the form of capitalism we've been pursuing here in the last 25 years has really been a radical form of consumerism that's ran the capitalistic system, but that's not really where I want to talk at. Mr. Inge and I, in 2003, at the beginning of this war, were talking about the reason we didn't want to go to this war, and I suggest that this problem we have today, even though it's tied to these bonds and strange things with the subprime mortgages, that really causes the problems of the subprime mortgages, and in the fact that we borrowed money for this war completely. We have not paid out of our pockets at all. That forced the interest rates way up, and that started people to start defaulting on their mortgages and led us to this problem. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I guess I disagree. The global money supply was very high compared to demand for money in the period after the tech and U.S. stock market collapse of 2001. Globally, not just in the United States, central banks were pursuing fairly expansionary monetary policies. So the money supply was growing relative to demand, and interest rates were very, very low. I last refinanced my mortgage, I think in 2003, at rates I still can't get today. That fueled the appetite for some of these fancy engineered financial products, the derivatives. So it may be true that we should have been raising taxes using contractionary fiscal policy to finance the war. That probably would have been, you know, a very, very fiscally prudent, if politically unpopular, thing to do. I always think it's better for taxpayers to have to put their pocketbooks behind the wars that they vote for. But from a monetary policy perspective, we were pursuing a very, very expansionary policy, which, you know, did allow us to borrow, that allowed the U.S. government to borrow at very, very low interest rates. But I don't think that monetary policy was expansionary in the U.S. in order to finance the war, because it was expansionary around the world. I don't know whether that answers your question or.
Well, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so I hope that at least gets in part to the question. I wanted to go on and talk with somebody else, get at least one other caller. Piatt County is next. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. What I'm not real happy with on this is that basically the people the Obama administration has to deal with this are the people that had a great part to do with creating it. I don't know, maybe the idea is that they can reverse engineer it. However, what I'm really unhappy about beyond that is that there's no participation that I can discern by organized labor in this. There's no union peoples, you know, they have staff economists and so on and so forth that could help besides the leaders of the unions, and I'd like to see Obama pick people like Paul Krugman also, Dean Baker, and Champaign's own Mark Weisbrot. Bring them in on this instead of these Wall Street people that appear to be just funneling money back to their former employers. That's all I got.
Well, all right, Professor Maxfield, comment?
Well, you know, unions are tough for the Obama team because they've tried to, again, you know, be moderate and listen to the unions, but also signal to anti-union folks that, you know, they're not going to be beholden to unions. That was certainly a political point that they drove home really hard before they clinched the nomination, because they were trying to portray Hillary Clinton as, you know, beholden to unions. You know, I think Obama has listened to many perspectives almost to a fault on the economy. If you read the international financial press, he's pretty much getting skewered right now. You know, nobody thinks he's doing a particularly good job, you know, in the international financial world. I think that's because he's been listening to too many people. You know, The Economist had an editorial in the last couple of weeks saying, you know, we were afraid he was not, his problem was going to be that he wasn't experienced enough to make up his own mind, and we worry that that's basically what's unfolding. I think he's listening to the voice of labor as he thinks about this. I think he's listening to the voice of Main Street very carefully, and that's partly the voice of labor. But, you know, I'd come back to the previous 8 years, and I think, you know, we got into this mess because we had an administration that was at the complete opposite end of the spectrum from the Obama administration. If they can be faulted for listening to too many stakeholders, the Bush administration wasn't listening to enough. And I know that union leaders and union economists were trying to make their voices heard and, you know, pretty much gave up in frustration. But I think that, you know, more debate and more consultation about economic policy is always a very, very healthy thing, and I believe in economic literacy because I think it's what, you know, makes the vagaries of capitalism less impactful.
Hmm. One more caller here, Atlanta, Illinois, line 3. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll make this brief. The one thing I think economists really make the mistake in doing, which you tend to predict what I'm going to say, is that maybe growth isn't the answer. Somebody you probably know about is Donella Meadows, and she thought development was the answer. But every economist I've heard, we're going to grow our way out of this mess, and I think it's really wrong, and I'll stop.
And I would agree with that, and I would agree with the caller, the prior caller, who said the model of capitalism we have has been rampant consumerism, and that was what I was alluding to when I said that growth had been driven in the U.S. increasingly in the last decades by U.S. consumers at the expense of all kinds of other sources of growth. I think we're gonna live out a restructuring of the U.S. economy, where we don't see the kind of growth that that this country saw in the 50s and the 60s, or certainly in the 90s under the Clinton administration. You know, we'll be lucky to have average growth rates over the next 10 to 20 years of 2%, I think. I think the era of rapid growth for the U.S. is over. But I do think that growth will fuel and consumer growth will fuel the Brazils and Indias and Chinas of the world. But it'll mean that our lives in the U.S. and perhaps our model of capitalism has to change.
We have about a minute, maybe a minute and a half. Unfair to ask a big question, but the president's going to be in London. He's attending the big economic group of 20 summit meeting, and there seems to be a lot of resistance in leaders of other countries to the idea that what's needed here is big economic stimulus by government. You know, I think he would like to see other governments do what the United States has done, and there seems to be a lot of resistance. Any possibility you think that that's going to change?
Well, you know, the biggest resistance has come from the Germans, who are a very powerful voice in the European world, and I don't think that's going to change. You know, Germany was heavily scarred by hyperinflation related to its own war in the middle of the last century. So I think you're going to see Angela Merkel remain somebody who says, you know what, we've got to be really, really fiscally conservative. We're going to live within our means, and you know, we're going to have to get through this without a massive stimulus. The French have been singing a different tune. You know, they were the French government was sending out checks to people to trade in their old cars and buy new ones. I think the Chinese are trying to step up to the plate, but I don't think we're going to get as much stimulus from the Germans and through them from the European Union as we might like. Probably means that the euro continues to strengthen against the U.S. dollar. But I think, you know, I think we're going to have to go it partly alone and look to the Brazilians or the Chinese or the Indians or countries with current account surpluses.
Well, there we'll have to stop. I'm sure we'll get back to many of these topics on future programs. But for the moment, we'll leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Sylvia Maxfield. She is Associate Professor of Management at Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts. Professor Maxfield, thanks very much.
Thank you all. And thanks to the listeners for their great questions. Mm-hmm.